It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Kareth and Giroux, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here, that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Okay, Stephanie will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Stephanie. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA memberships. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, please grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Max will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Max. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Marty will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Marty, and I am an alcoholic. 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Deb.
Hi, I'm Deb. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, my sobriety date is May 13th, 01, and my sponsor is Heidi. And I spent the first 2 years of my sobriety here. And I have nothing but love for this room and the people in it. And I see Jeff and Ava. And I remember I was just was thinking so much about my first month or couple of weeks here. And I knew that I needed to be here. I was very confused, very upset that I had reached this point again, and I think this time was for real. But yet, although I sat there with the biggest lip curl and snarl, and I would listen, but I knew I felt magnetized somehow. This is the last thing I tried and the first thing that worked for me. I am just so grateful to be here. And I remember this group in particular, like driving down and just being so sad, because what happened at the end of my drinking was I thought I was mentally insane, because who does the things that I was doing? And it, you know, with drinking, like, why is it that, you know, I'm the only one leaving this bar in, you know, handcuffs, or like, why am I the only one going, you know, feeling this way at home? And I thought I was going out to have a good time. It all started out to, you know, and also the other thing I found out in sobriety, I heard a lot of people come into this room and they'd stand at the podium and they'd be very excited to be sober. I just came from a concert, and it's the first concert I saw sober. I mean, I was like, what? If we were going to a concert, we were getting, I wanted to be more excited. Like, I also needed it to get by and then to get really through, like, to get above and beyond. So when I got here, I was still not interested in seeing the concert sober. I was interested in, like, also still feeling great all the time, all the time. I have a feeling I'm going to feel good all the time. Push it away, push it away. So coming here, I'm not really interested in drinking still, really, or, like, learning how to drink here. I was really interested in learning how to live sober, because what I was doing drunk was not working anymore. So how do you, you know, I was talking about this yesterday, you know, feeling, you know, how do you get sad in sobriety and not pick up a drink? How do you get really mad and not have something to, you know, just a little, you know, just a little edge off, you know? I need to take the edge off, because and then it's like I didn't realize I also what I learned here was I had the allergy that I'm not just going to take the edge off. We all know that an alcoholic who picks up a drink, you take the edge off for 5 minutes. And then it's like, you know, the illness takes over. And when you don't know, for me, that I didn't know I had that, I really started to think it was insanity. Because, you know, I had, you know, my girlfriends pull me aside and say, you know, Deb, when we're not with you, we worry about you, or, you know, like, are you, and I really was like, I want to come home. I mean, I want to do the right thing, but, you know, I didn't realize that it's the first drink, and then I have the allergy, it kicks in, no matter what I'm going to do, it's going to be, so then I remember I had a therapist who would say, you know, I went for my anorexia. I was very sick with anorexia, and she kept saying, but, you know, what about that drinking? Go back, go back, go back. And I kept saying, like, no, because that is, like, the solution for me. Like, I, you know, when you keep bringing up the drinking, it's kind of making me annoyed. And she was like, because what you're doing is you're telling me you're doing something. And I had tremendous, tremendous anxiety. paralyzing fears and paralyzing anxiety that, you know, could like kill an elephant. I just, and that is what, you know, to self, I had the medication of the alcohol to self-medicate. So now you're telling me, you know, maybe you shouldn't be drinking so much. And without any sort of understanding of that, what I heard was, you might as well just die. That is a dark day. For me, it was, you know? And so thank you. So then I came to, you know, I did. I've had my stomach pumped. I've had handcuffs on. I've been very, very ill from this. But the last night of my drinking probably wasn't even like the worst drunk, but something happened and I don't care. I just am so grateful for that moment. And I looked at my husband, wasn't my husband at the time, and I said the morning after, I said, I can't drink anymore. And I thought he was going to be like, you know, we've had the talk before, but he was like, great, great. Like that's a good day for you. And I was like, because what that meant to me was death row, really. I mean, that for real. Like, he didn't understand that. Like, someone who doesn't have this illness will give you, like, a major thumbs up. Good for you. It's like, well, what next? And I called my father, who's sober, you know, now over 25 years, and he was like, he just started to cry. Because I think he'd been waiting for that day. So I started coming to meetings. I was hysterical crying probably for the first 3 months, and a beautiful blonde tapped me on the shoulder and was like, she could see it from a million miles away, and she just said, you know, I'm going to speak at this meeting. And I don't know what it was, but I was like, okay, I just did it. And then the other thing I was thinking about was, I knew this was great because, I didn't know that then, but I do know this now. Like, one of the reasons I really stayed and was excited to stay, I really wasn't excited, but I can say that now, but there wasn't anybody that was who really was working this program that was saying, it's terrible. The worst thing you'll ever try. You may not want to do this. I mean, everybody was swarming me and saying, this is awesome. Like, you should really try this, you know? Look at these promises. I mean, the promises are heavy. Like, that's what I've been looking for. What I've been looking for in the drink, I am receiving in the steps, but it is not turning on me. And that is what was happening with alcohol. It was just turning on me all the time. It was getting very upsetting. And then I heard, you know, so I wanted to, you know, I really wanted to try this out for myself. And I just thought, you know what, if I'm going to really do this, I really think I wasn't thinking this. I think I'm thinking this now over me. But I was thinking, I'm really going to try it. And I did. I went through the book with the way it's laid out in the book. And I mean, what do you know? I just, you know, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I like that I've heard this in other meetings, not because I'm nice, not because I'm kind of cool, but because you get one when you do the work. I mean, that's what it says. And it's everyone that I've seen or taken through, it's been happening. And I think after 5 years, somebody told me, like, after 5 years, I remember having 1 year and being like, I got 1 year, just like give that, you know, because it's amazing. A day of sobriety is wonderful when you're an alcoholic. But I've, spiritually, I'm so grateful because I have 2 children as a gift of this program. And it's like I suffer from tremendous fear and anxiety. And being a mother, it's, I mean, of 2 small boys, I am on fire at all times because there may be fire in my house at like any moment with these 2 boys. But I had to, like, I reached another spiritual bottom, like, yeah, well, does God got it or not? And I really started to feel that, like, I'm so grateful to come and hear other people because, you know, I know that I still need to, because guess what? Like, somebody's going to throw amnesia dust on me, like, when I go sit down, because it's, I got to keep hearing this. You know, and that's another thing that I have an understanding of. Thank you. That, you know, I'll be crying with one of my closest friends in the local friendlies. Okay, this is like a child establishment. We're eating Sundays. You know, I'm crying. And she's giving me the gold. Like, she's giving me the, you know, the program. And I'm like, you know, next week you're going to be in this seat and I'm going to be giving you the same thing. I mean, we know we need to hear it over and over and over and over, which is great. So I'm delighted to be here, which, I mean, anyone that I think, remembers me coming in here that on the first day is, I mean, I think I'm, I mean, if anything, a little nicer. But I'm so grateful. This is a design for living that really works for me. I'm just so grateful I'm still here, and I thank you for my sobriety. Thank you.
Our second minute, a 10-minute speaker is Brian.
Hi, Atlanta Group. My name is Brian Anthony, and I'm an alcoholic. OMFG, Atlanta Group, this is really scary. I have to tell you, a friend said when I came up here to imagine the room in their underwear, but that's freaking me out even more, so... It's going to take a mental minute to dress you all back up. Parrots, I know you've got a great body, but even you have got to put in a full body snowsuit. I can't do this. But my sobriety date is April 26th, 2008. John P. is my sponsor. Living in Step 9, working Step 9, living in 10, 11, and 12. And Atlantic Group is my home group. In a very general way, I'd like to share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But before I do so, I'd like to thank Eddie for asking me to be of service at my home group. This is really a privilege and a privilege for me. And most importantly, I want to welcome the newcomer. I've been a newcomer here on numerous occasions. I know what it's like to be sitting out there in a seat, feeling like your skin is crawling, like you want to be anywhere but here. I just want to reassure you that you're in a safe, loving place. I needed to hear that on numerous occasions. And on numerous occasions, my home group watched me run out the door in tears. I have loved the Atlantic Group. I've hated the Atlantic Group. I married AA. I divorced AA. I span and I spinned. And although I kept moving, AA was always here. And all my high-powered precision thinking couldn't deny the fact that you were the one stable thing in my life. And that stability saved my life. So in a general way, what happened? Life for me was completely unmanageable long before I ever picked up a drink. Somebody from the podium once said that when they were in the third grade, they were ready for their first drink. And I really identified with that. Although I was like, my mother should have just spiked the formula, baby formula. I think I was ready the minute I arrived in the planet. I really do. Some of my earliest memories... really go back to just that sense of dis-ease and discomfort. Everybody seemed to smile brighter than I did. Everybody's laugh was louder than my own. I felt very disconnected from the world around me. And that's really how I moved through my life, long before I ever picked up a drink. I think that's an important thing to note, that alcoholism has very little to do with how much alcohol we consume. It's much more to do with our spiritual condition and just the way we perceive the world around us. When I turned 16, I witnessed a vibrant Italian woman, my mother, die from cancer, and it had a profound effect on me. Shortly thereafter, my best friend died. He died of alcoholism. He passed out, vomited while unconscious, and basically drowned in his own vomit. I swore I would never pick up a drink. Shortly thereafter, my father died. I had no capacity to deal with these tragedies in my life. I tried to kill myself. This is something that our big book warns about, just being a prey to depression and fear and all of these things. And that is how I coped with the tragedies around me. So basically, as you could see, my life was unmanageable, and the way I handled the exaggerated emotions that I had was to try to kill myself, and that's how I lived my life. Age 26 came, and I found myself on a dance floor in the Palladium. And yes, I am a boy from the 80s. And, you know, talk about that I have arrived moment. I had my first drink on that dance floor at age 26. Never drank before then. And I felt for the first time in my life that the weight of the world had been lifted from me. And in that moment, I swear to you, I knew I wanted more and more and more. I wanted to feel better and better and better. I just had a sense that this was not going to be a good thing. Although it was the first time that I just was able to be comfortable, I felt handsome, I felt like I could dance, I felt like I could talk to people, and I wasn't alone. I lived much of my life very alone. To make a long story short, the progression of my alcoholism lasted for the next 12 years. To get right down to it, what had turned out being a party on a dance floor ended up being a man who was emotionally unstable, a man who had on numerous occasions tried to commit suicide, a man who ended up in a psychiatric hospital against his will because I couldn't stop drinking, a man who, after my parents died, worked to get through school, worked in a job, could no longer pay his rent. I had destroyed everything in my life because I couldn't stop drinking. That's what it was like, and that's what happened. What it is like now, well, let me just back up a little bit. The night I met the sponsor I currently have, and there were so many amazing people in this room who have loved me and helped me along the way, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to hear your voices and take your hand when you extended it to me. I'm grateful to be standing here today. Jeff Rossman, you once told me when I first came through these doors to get a suit and to step over the bodies, and I hated him for saying that to me. I did, but he was only telling me the truth. I think I hated anyone who told me the truth. And I had the unfortunate experience of stepping over many bodies of many friends. And for me to be standing here tonight is pretty amazing. I've spent 5 years trying to get sober. It didn't come easy to me. DeVita reminded me that I had gone to Pockets of Enthusiasm for 2 years in a row, and 2 years in a row, I was the recipient of the big book that all the guests signed, and that recipient went to the person who had the least amount of sobriety, and that was 2 years in a row. So I really want to stand here as an example that I kept coming back. No matter what my head told me, I kept hearing AA tell me, I'm welcome, please coming back. If I didn't hear that, I don't know that I would be standing here this evening. Again, it's a tremendous gift for a man who thought so little of his life that I could stand here today and say I'm so grateful for the life that I have been given. You know, one of the gifts that I've been given in sobriety is to take all of the experience I have with my alcoholism and share it with another man. I have a sponsee named Dominic, and he's given me the privilege of sharing this gift with him. And there were many years that I hated the fact that I was an alcoholic. I certainly couldn't see how this was a benefit to me or anybody around me. But it's almost like when you hear a parent for the first time say they look at the world differently. I see the world a lot differently today. I see how my experience can maybe be a little bit of hope for somebody sitting out in the room tonight. I can't help but notice the last row. That's as far as I got into this building the first night that I came to the Atlantic Group, was the last row. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about what it was like for me getting sober. You know, the night I met my sponsor, I was down at the meeting on, I think it was called Straight 12, and a girlfriend of mine had begged me to come back to AA. I had divorced you and left you for good. And I couldn't even get into the meeting. But he was standing outside the rooms that night, and for some reason, with all the insanity going on and all the noise in my head, I could hear this man's voice. And it comforted me. And you know, I had to hit such a bottom emotionally and financially, physically. I mean, in every way, shape, form, I was a man bankrupt and literally brought to my knees. I'm grateful for that because it gave me the capacity to hear what this man had to say. And although I've given many of you a difficult time and an argument on what you might recommend or suggest I do to stay sober, I don't do that with my sponsor today. I listen with an open heart, an open mind. I only have 1 minute left, and wow, they weren't kidding when they said this was going to go really fast. Welcome again to the newcomer Atlantic Group. thank you for always welcoming me back. I'm a very humbled man this evening. 5 years it's taken me to get to this podium, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Thank you.
I thought I would never get up here. You know what it's like. Oh, but I take comfort. I'm in a church. And I was looking at these candles. My grandmother lit so many candles for me. And I guess it worked, because here I am sober in front of the Atlantic Group. And I heard so much about the Atlantic Group. Clancy Eye, I have to say, is my favorite speaker. And I was introduced by someone to him. He told me, you got to come to Atlantic Group on Tuesday night. I think it was in August. Let me look at my watch. And hear this speaker. So that's how I found out about the Atlantic Group. And I came here and listened to Clancy Eye. And I listened to him today. I downloaded him at work. Some talk he gave in 1999 at Redondo Beach. And boy, was he in a mood. He was making fun of everybody. But I love that about Clancy. He's got that little touch of cynicism and reality, which I like. As a matter of fact, I downloaded a fourth step that he uses. You know, these questions that to ask people before they do their fourth step. And I use that with my sponsees. I came into AA in May 1990. And I do recall the sponsor that I had, her name was B. She said, you know what you need to do? You need to audition to speak at the Bill W. dinner dance. And I was like, okay. And I must have had 2 years, but believe me, I felt like I had 3 months. And I feel like I auditioned here. I just have a, but you're not here 20 years, are you? No, right, so it must have been another place. But I'm telling you the story, that's how I got here. So practically every year I audition for the big meeting and the Bill W. dinner dance. I just look at it now as a speaking commitment, really. It doesn't bother me at all. And last year I think the Manhattan Group hosted, and I almost made it. I made alternate. But this year I tried out, and it was at the 79th Street Workshop, and this Ava was sitting next to me who I didn't know. And we were both, you know, trying out to get this gig. And neither one of us got it, but I was smart. I took her number, and I called her up, and she was a wonderful person, called me back. And she said, you know, I'm going to get you a speaking commitment at the Atlantic Group. And I said, yeah, sure. Sure enough, the next week, Jeff called me, and I just was thrilled to pieces. I'm just so happy to be here. I've heard nothing but good things about the Atlantic Group. But enough of that happy stuff. Let's flash back a little bit to why I'm in AA. And it wasn't happy. The thing is, I was a happy kid till I was 10. I don't know what happened. I think it was my mother. But, this is my theory. And I developed this complex. And because I grew up in a European home, my mother's from Belgium. And by the way, are there any Belgians here? Because there are no alcoholics in Belgium, okay? It's just a social custom. And this is what my mother still tells me. What do you mean you're an alcoholic? There's no such thing. Meanwhile, her father was a staggering drunk, but that's all right. So, and my mother is from Belgium, and she came over here. She met my father when he was stationed in the army. My father, my darling father, Richard, who taught me love. And my father is Jewish, and my mother is Catholic. But obviously neither one of them practiced any religion because they married each other. And so I grew up in a non-religious household, but you see how God works in mysterious ways. My mother was quite having a terrible time here because she didn't speak the language, so she invited her parents to come from Belgium. The atheistic, alcoholic, socialist, my grandfather, and the devout Catholic, my grandmother, who had my mother by immaculate conception. So my grandmother was a great influence in my life. She taught me love also, and my father was a very loving, kind person and taught me all kinds of wonderful things, introduced me to literature, science, the Philharmonic, ballet. But that's not what I wanted. I wanted love and acceptance. That's all I could ever think about. Love and acceptance. And if I didn't get it the way I wanted it, forget it. It was like the end of the world. Life is over. I'm hopeless. I'm doomed. Nobody likes me. It's the end of the world. And this is how I went through high school. The fellow that I fell in love with in high school was this poor, forlorn-looking creature. You know, he had, like, beautiful brown eyes. He was very thin. He looked like a doe. And I always liked to participate in things, you know. So I worked in the late pass office, and I always was getting crushes on all the teachers, all the male teachers. So I got a job working in the late pass office. I think his name was Mr. Feldman, who ran the late pass office. And in walks this fellow, this poor, sad soul. And I was like, you know what? I'm in love. So he comes from a horrible home. He's got, you know, he's living with his alcoholic grandparents. His mother is nuts. His father is nuts. His sister is schizophrenic. And this is the guy I bring home to Whitestone. You know, here, look who I've brought home. He was an alcoholic. And I bring him home, and my parents immediately forbid me to see him. And, of course, I never listened to anything my parents told me. Believe me, I wouldn't be here. Well, I'd probably be here. But, you know, I'd like to think that if I had only listened to them, I might not be here. But I'm an alcoholic. I was born with it. It's an allergy. It's not my choice that I'm an alcoholic. And so I brought him home, and it was a terrible, a lot of angst in the house, and misery, and misery, and misery. And, you know, I would make drinks. My parents are normal drinkers, which, you know what that means. They can have one or two, and they don't develop the phenomenon of craving. I definitely have that. I'm the only alcoholic in my little family. I have a sister who, if you give her a sip of sherry, she goes, oh, my God, that's too much. You know. And I got to tell you this one story just so you understand. So I've been drinking big time now, right? I married an alcoholic. I knew him 3 months. I eloped. I wanted to get away from home. I was drunk at City Hall when I signed the papers. So I was insane at the age of 22. So my drinking progressed. I left him because, you know what? He's worse than me. I'm not the alcoholic. He's much worse than me. I just need a different environment. You know, I need a better class of people to hang out with. That's what I need. So, you know, I ran back home to Whitestone, and I'd come home bombed, and my mother one day said to me, that's it. No, you can't live here. And I was like, well, it's all your fault anyway. And I lived in furnished rooms. I lived in hotels carrying a pint of vodka in my pocketbook. I became totally dependent on alcohol. It mastered me. You know, Bill Wilson talks about that. I was the slave. It was my master. But, you know, knowing that means nothing. I had no defense against that first drink. So anyway, the drinking progresses, and my father would, I lived in some dump in Astoria, you know, who cared where I lived, you know, just as long as I could afford it. So I had some job that I could care less about. As long as I had that alcohol, life was going to be good. And this one particular day, my father would pick me up to go to Whitestone, where I grew up, for, you know, to spend the weekend with the family or the evening, and he picks me up at 1 o'clock, and he says to me, have you been drinking? What is that smell? I smell like you've been drinking. I said, no, of course I haven't been drinking. I wouldn't drink at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Meanwhile, I've used mouthwash. I've taken all kinds of, you know, lozenges. And so I walk in the door, and my mother goes to me, you are allowed to have 2 drinks. That's it, just 2 drinks. But that's no problem. So I take the glass. I put in 6 ounces of vodka, little tab of orange juice, and I just down that one. And I'm on fire already. And I go, I said, so mother, I'm going to have my second drink now. Sure, go ahead. And I pour another 6 ounces, and I put another drop of orange juice in it. And my sister, I don't know if she did it on purpose, she tastes the drink. And she goes, oh my God, this is pure alcohol. And I'm, Georgia, please, please be quiet. I don't want them to know. You can imagine the state I must have been in. I've drank like, you know, 14 ounces of vodka, and it's only 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But I'm still thirsty. Alcoholic, right? So I go down into the finished basement, And my mother calls, and I'm swilling out of the bottle now. You know, my father had this really fancy bar, and there are actually some bottles left that I didn't get to because I got sober. Anyway, my mother goes, "What are you doing down there?" "I'm looking at my college books." So, you know, the whole family was in denial about it, and they didn't know what to do about it anyway. But alcohol was the convincer. So this is how I led my life. This is what I would say to myself on a Saturday, and I started off in nice bars on Lexington Avenue, but I always ended up with the drunk in the bar. And you know how Bill Wilson talks about no real infidelity happened with other women? That's because he was too drunk. That's what he means by that. So I met this great guy. He was an advertising executive. I figured, oh, an advertising executive, you know, better class of people. Of course, I end up with the drunk in the group. And we would end up, you know, falling down drunks on a grate on 3rd Avenue. That's the alcoholic. So I ended up drinking in a dingy, dirty bar called McGrath's that I could get into right after I get off the subway on 30th Avenue. And I went in there with my New York Times, right, thinking I'm better than all these people. And I liked that bar because I could deny what I had done to my life by looking at them and saying they're worse than me. 5 years later, I was thrown out of that bar because the bartender, Gaz, who lives in my building now, would say to me, "You know, Laura, you're just so pathetic. I don't want you to come in here anymore." Because I'd go in there and I would say to myself, "You know what? I'm just going to go in for two. You know, I'm just going to go in and have to that mental obsession that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different." So now I've got that physical allergy and the mental obsession that I can't differentiate the true from the false. And this allows me to keep on drinking. And what does the big book tell me? Spiritual malady. There is only one solution. You must be converted. You must have a conversion experience. And I was like, "No, that's not going to happen. I don't believe in conversion experiences." So I get thrown out of this bar. I go to my doctor. I have this other problem that, believe me, is so horrible, I wouldn't even want to tell you about it. But my alcoholism is so I go to my doctor, and she says, "Your liver is all swollen." And she never said to me, you know, "How much are you drinking?" I had the red face. You know, it was 185 pounds. She said, "You know, did I stop drinking after she told me that my liver was swollen and that I could die or end up in the hospital?" Liver disease is a terrible thing. It's a horrible thing to have. But, you know, didn't mean anything to me because I was powerless over this alcohol. So, you know, I lose my 15th job. And, you know, this job, I'm a legal assistant, and I worked for this law firm, and the man I worked for was everything I wanted to be, except the man part. He was a lawyer. I admire lawyers. I think they're very smart. He was a religious man. He believed in God. And he had a family that he loved. And there I was, such a reject. I had destroyed everything. And I wanted to be like him. And I worked for him, and I did my best. But by the end of my drinking, I hated anybody that was normal because I knew I wasn't. And I just had this horrible attitude, and, you know, I was very demoralized, and as we know, we would say now spiritually bankrupt is the word, and I hated myself, and I hated anybody that was normal. And I probably caused a lot of trouble at that job, even though I was a very good worker, and they liked me. So I get called into the office by the partner, and he says, "Well, we have to let you go." And, you know, I felt so horrible, but I knew they had to let me go. But that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because that's called that gift of desperation, where no job, eviction notice under the door, no family. I was a lone wolf, no friends. And there I am sitting in my apartment in my flannel nightgown, you know, desperate to stop drinking. So I tried tele-evangelism, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. "I give my life to Jesus." Nothing worked. Nothing didn't happen. I went to psychiatrists. That took too long. That didn't work. I tried religion. I went into churches all over the place. Synagogues, I was a little embarrassed to go into. I don't know why. But, I tried that. I tried dieting. I know what it was. I tried colonics. If I purge myself of all these toxins, my brain will just clear up. So I got on this exercise regimen. So I would run around the park. You know, I mean, really, I'm 185 pounds. My whole body is toxic. And, you know, I'd be exhausted now after trying to run around the park. I'm not athletic, please. And so I would, like, I need a drink. I end up right back in my grass, you know, drunk. So then, you know, I remember crying to my sister one day, I can't go on living like this, you know. And my sister is a transcendental meditator. Are there any TMers here? So I don't say anything horrible. But anyway, she says, you need to learn to meditate. That's what you need to do. I said, but Georgia, I can't meditate while I'm drunk. So I said, what else can I do? She says, I know. I know this Chinese doctor. Her name is Dr. Law, and she's in Forest Hills. Now, Forest Hills to me was a real leg up. You know what I mean? Forest Hills. So I go to Forest Hills. It's Queens Boulevard. The sun is, you know, glaring out. So I probably have a horrible hangover. And I walk into this doctor's office, and she's like 5'2". And the ceiling is down here. I just feel like I'm like this in this office. But that's how I remember it. It can't be true. So she says, lay down. So I lay down on this table and she starts pressing my liver, you know. And she goes, I can't do anything for you. You're toxic. Your whole body is toxic. She says, here, take these herbal pills. Maybe you'll go to the bathroom. So anyway, I leave the office and I call my sister from a phone booth on Queens Boulevard. Georgia, she told me I was toxic and that there's nothing she can do. My poor sister, she is like this lunatic, my sister. She had no idea what to do. So these are some of the ways that I tried to stop drinking, and then I found AA. And that's how I know this place is, you know. And then, of course, when I got here, some person said to me, you're a miracle. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. You're a miracle. So how did I hear about AA? Another, you know, you think about divine providence. I used to go to this bar to throw down a couple in this. And there was a guy, it was on Lexington Avenue, as a matter of fact, it's still there. I love passing it. And I don't go into bars at all. They just terrify me. Unless I have a good reason, a wedding or something. So I'm in there throwing down these couple because, you know, I'm nervous. So there's a guy in there, his name was Bill Stevenson, and he used to be drinking a Coca-Cola and have a roast beef sandwich or something. And he goes to me, you know, I've been watching you the way you drink, and I think you're an alcoholic. And I was like, you know what, you're right, I am. Can I have another drink, please? Yeah. So I would walk out with him because I had to dash back to work and sneak in the back door so they wouldn't see that I was slightly ossified, you know what I mean. So they caught me anyway. So he says to me, you know, why don't you, so we're standing on the corner of 42nd and Lexington, and he says to me, why don't you go to the Grand Central Group? And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the Grand Central Group. I never made it to the Grand Central Group. So that's where I heard about AA. So I drank for another 5 years, and then I made that phone call. I called up New York Intergroup, which I support, and I don't know what I said to the guy. He told me, do you want someone to come pick you up? I said, no, I do not want anyone to pick me up. I will get there myself. But I never made it to New York to the meeting. 2 weeks later, after, you know, sitting in my flannel nightgown and just horrible self-contempt and hatred, I called up AA again, and this time they told me, go to Astoria Topic. So I went to this Topic meeting. There was some woman standing there, Millie. She's still around. She gave me a meeting book, started talking to me about her boyfriend problems. So, you know, that should ring a bell. And she told me, go in the back. And I went in the back, and I don't remember what anybody said. And then she says, you know, they've just started a big book meeting in our neighborhood, and I want you to go with me. And for some unknown reason, I went with her, divine providence. And I went with her, and I heard them talk about gratitude, love, and service. And I was like, yes, that's what I want. That's what I've been looking for my whole life. And then I went to the bar. Then Friday night, I went to Astoria Group, and there was some guy standing in the front, and he goes to me, men with the men and women with the women. So I go, look, you know, I am interested in men, and I will be, but not right now. I don't know, that nonsensical thing they tell people, that it's not even AA, it's like, you know, rehab. So I walk in the meeting, and then I hear some other nonsensical thing. The guy says to me, so you're going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. I said, you know what, if I could not drink for 90 days, I don't think I'd be here right now. So, you know, thank God there was some other person there, and the guy says to me, oh, no, don't listen to him. No, I don't know if he really said that. But someone said to me, this is a 24-hour program. Why don't you try that? And that made sense to me, right? So that's what I'm doing. I think I've had a couple, you know. I mean, I don't have a sponsor. I feel like, you know, I'm trying to look attractive. And I'm certainly not going to make 90 meetings in 90 days anyway, because you told me to. So this one particular day, I wasn't going to go to the meeting. I said, you know what? I'm impure. I need to, like, it's not my mind at all. It's my diet. So I went to the store. I bought oranges. I bought broccoli, and I was going to steam the broccoli and squeeze the oranges. Now, I hadn't steamed broccoli or squeezed oranges in years. And I was on my way home, and another moment, see, I met these two AA women, and they must have remembered me. And they said, where are you going, Laura? I said, I'm going home. I'm very depressed. That was my middle name, Laura Depressed. And I had, my hair was in a bun, and I had on this, you know, big floppy dress because I was ugly. And it was ripped, and I had it pinned with a pin. You know, I mean, I come from a nice family. My mother was into fashion. My father loved the opera and the ballet. I'm walking around with a pinned dress. So they say to me, oh, you know what? There's a meeting right down the block. Why don't you come with us to the meeting? And I don't know why I went with them. I know why. It was the love in their eyes. That's why I went with them. So I said, yeah, but I look horrible. I don't want anybody to see me up close. She says, trust me, they're not even going to notice the way you look. They're too involved with themselves. We identify with that, right? So I said, okay. So I went with them, and they did something for me that started my sobriety. They made me secretary of the group. So my sobriety, started when I was introduced to service. It made me secretary of that group. And from that very instant, I started feeling better. I would go every Thursday and read those secretary notes. I started feeling better about myself. And plus, there was a really cute guy there that I had this crush on for 2 years, but nothing ever happened. That was very, very important. So, but you know, I'm doing the service. I'm going to meetings. Thank God somebody gave me Living Sober. As we all know, Barry L. wrote that. It's for newcomers. Thank God someone gave that to me. I was reading that book, and I had about 40 days. I had the service commitment, and I was still depressed. And someone said to me, you need a sponsor, someone who's going to introduce you to the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts. And I was like, okay, because I was desperate. I wanted to get well. I didn't want to stay sick. So I asked this woman to sponsor me. Her name was Coda. She left AA. And when I had about 7 months, she just said we were a bunch of whiners and complainers. And she left. I don't know. I think she's in New Mexico somewhere now. But she did the right thing for me. She introduced me to step one in her beautiful apartment. And I told her my story. She told me her story. And there it was. I was insane when it came to alcohol. I had to admit that. She then said, you're sober 40 days. Would you be willing to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity? I said, that sounds so good. I was a philosophy major in college. I love stuff like that. And I said, but I don't know what that means, a capital P power. I'm the only power I know, and look how miserable I've done, and human beings have let me down anyway my whole life. Ooh, 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 ooh. So, you know, that old song. And old it is. So she said, well, how many days have you not had a drink? And I was happened to have been a daily drinker. I said, yeah, I think I have like 40 days. She says, well, how do you think that you have stayed sober for 40 days? Do you think it might have some, not in that tone. Do you think it might have something to do with Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, that's right. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. So she says, that's a power greater than you. I got it, I said. That's right. Second step, right there, right there. You know, how long did it take? The evidence was there. I was not going to argue with it. The third step, however, was a different story. Because I misunderstood it. I thought that at that very moment, when I said that third step prayer from the big book, you know, I offer myself to God, that I had to turn everything over. And I couldn't. I didn't know how to turn anything over. And she explained to me, no, that's just your decision to have the courage and faith to do the rest of the AA program. I said, oh, that I can manage. And she said, now I want you just to say that third step prayer every morning and get on your knees and thank God, as you understand God right now, for your sobriety. And I did that. And we did a fourth and fifth step. We did six and seven, which, as we all know, is a daily thing. And by the way, I want to tell anybody that's new today, I heard a lot of people with 10 days and stuff like that. This is easy to do. There's nothing hard about it. I love the whole thing. And she left AA. I had to get another sponsor. The sponsor I got, I didn't choose. But in the interim, I met this guy, Pat Hickey, who I consider my sponsor. You know Pat, right? And he introduced me to this idea of faith, to trust in God. And I met him when I had about 1 year. And I remember him telling me about the big book. And about, you know, he was a bad drunk. He ended up on a park bench. So, like, if I was having a bad day and I would call him, and I'd say, well, how come you never have any bad days? He says, because I have gratitude that I'm not on a park bench. And it was as simple as that. It's just as simple as that. Not that it's as simple as that. But, another important time in my sobriety, I had about 5 years, and I wasn't doing a tenth step. I wasn't taking that, you know, spot check inventory. I wasn't turning to God. I was not spending any really time in prayer and meditation to improve the conscious contact I made in 3 through 9. I wasn't doing that. And what happened to me is I fell back into a faithless hull, and I felt alone. And there was this woman in AA that had a little bit more time than me, but she was always so full of faith, and she had such hope. And I said, you know what, I'm going to ask her how she does it. And her name was Anne, and she says, I hope you don't mind, but I would like to start the steps over if you don't mind. But what's the big deal? How long does it take to do 1 through 3? So I did it over. I did a fourth step. She had her own way of doing it. I like the big book way. We did it. And you know what? It happened for me. All those resentments that had accumulated went away. I gave them away, and I was back on the road. Then about 5 years later, I once again got very angry about life. And I wasn't doing my prayer and meditation, and I met this, and I was just in a terrible state of mind, really, really bad state of mind, full of self-pity. It was ruling my life. And I finally just surrendered to God. And I just want to talk about God for 1 minute. I was agnostic when I got here, and this is a highly spiritual program. It is not a religion. I read all the books, and I'm very interested, you know, so we know that. But, so I didn't believe in God. I thought I could not make the connection. But I still read all the spiritual literature. I still prayed to God. They made me go on these horrible retreats that I couldn't stand. I remember I had to go to the, I went on this one retreat. It wasn't, you know, AA doesn't do retreats, but people in AA get together and they do retreats. But this was a totally non-AA retreat, and I had to wear a button that said, God doesn't make junk. And I was like, I refuse to wear that button. It's so tacky. I'm not wearing a yellow button. They were like, we're going to have a tough time with that one. So I have 1 minute left. So it's 20 years later. I have lots of sponsees, thank God, throughout my life, my sobriety. I think I've sponsored about 75 women. Most of them are all happy and still sober. The 12th step is very important. My home group is Alcoholics in Action in Astoria. We're a big book study. Right now we're doing a little red book study. You are all welcome. Thank you. I want to thank Ava, Jeff, the Atlanta Group for giving me this opportunity to see all your beautiful faces. Thank you.